welcome to the Bethany House Seven Stories podcast. Bethany House is the home of the Wood Hath Hope Christian Community in Syracuse, New York, and Seven Stories is a Bible study guide that teaches us how to understand the non-violent God of Jesus, who is revealed in the scriptures. In these podcasts, we are going to take some time to talk to different people about how coming together to study these stories has affected our lives. Now, Seven Stories grew out of the Wood Hath Hope Christian Community's Bible studies over many years. My name is Linda Bartlett. I am a long-term member of the Wood Hath Hope Christian Community, and I will be facilitating today's discussion. And with me is my husband, Tony Bartlett, also a founding member of Wood Hath Hope, who is our theologian in residence. He will help to explain biblical or theological discussion points as we go on. And our special guest today is Heather Scanlon. She is a key Wood Hath Hope member and has been part of our community for 14 years. She is a massage therapist, a yoga instructor, and now also a student nurse. She is married with three children. Heather, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Wood Hath Hope members have come together around a non-violent understanding of God. We have different spiritual backgrounds and have had different spiritual journeys that have led us to this place. So before we begin our discussion, Heather, can you tell us a little of your own spiritual journey?
Yes, thank you. Yes, I've been part of the community for 14 years. I've been studying with you guys for a while. And I grew up heavily influenced by my evangelical grandmother, who loved Jesus so much, and the scriptures were extremely important to her. And also my father, who was kind of a sensitive New Age guy, and he did a lot of yoga and meditation, more Eastern stuff. So I ended up living in an ashram for a year and just being one of those spiritual seekers, kind of looking. Mm-hmm. And when I finally found this community, I was so happy because I was able to remove all those kind of barriers that were there with the Christianity, with the violence, so that I could be closer to Jesus. So that's been really valuable to me.
That's fantastic. So, turning now to the Seven Stories. As the title tells us, Seven Stories identifies seven major themes of transformation working through the text of the Bible. For example, the first story, which is Oppression to Justice, is the Exodus account in which God is seen for the first time to take the side of the poor and the oppressed and brings them together as a people. If you have the book, you'll see that each of these themes or stories is divided into three lessons. The first two lessons of each story in each cycle draw more from the Old Testament writings, and the third lesson focuses on Jesus's radical interpretation of this tradition. So Heather, which theme, lesson, or story was particularly meaningful to you?
I want to talk about today the third story, which is the story of the land and its loss, mm-hmm. and particularly the first, the first lesson that deals with the Deuteronomic voice.
Okay.
This was really powerful for me because I grew up, reading the Bible. I was encouraged to read the Bible, that it was the living word and the authority of the text. And I had that in my heart. And a lot of the passages in Deuteronomy are some of my favorite passages, where they're describing this God loving, such a loving God. And then there are these passages where God is like punishing and violent. And so what I did before I met you guys is I would literally just cross those passages out that were violent and nasty. And it didn't feel right because I felt like I was taking more authority than God or the scripture. But at the same time, I thought, how could I be more loving than God? So what you did here is you really helped me with that problem, and it kind of reclaimed the text, and it became even more powerful as I read it.
That's great. So Tony, maybe before we continue, Can you give an explanation of the Deuteronomic voice or the Deuteronomic worldview, and why do you think that voice emerged in the Bible?
Sure. Yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk about these things and be here with you and Heather. When we talk about a voice in the Bible, we mean to say that there are numerous different angles on different subjects given in the Bible, different points of view, really. And the really obvious example, and there are lots of them, but for example, the whole story of the Book of Kings is retold in the Book of Chronicles, the Books of Chronicles 1 and 2. So why tell the story over again unless there's a different angle, a different way of looking at this thing, a different message being proposed? And that's the case also with the Book of Deuteronomy and the Deuteronomic voice, shall we say, as Heather has said. Deuteronomy means the second law, the law given the second time. So Exodus, the Book of Exodus, gives us the first telling of the law, and Deuteronomy does it another time, a second. So why is that? There must be another angle on it, another view, another world view. And the reason is that the Book of Exodus is written out of the actual experience of the Exodus and the giving of the law way back, shall we say, in the 12th century or the 13th century before Christ. And Deuteronomy is written much later out of the experience of the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and the loss of the land. It's a whole different life event for the Jewish people. And it's written from that perspective, although you hear it as Moses and the people are just about to enter the land. So they retell the story. And something is a way of trying to explain that is as if someone was giving a commencement address or a graduation address, and it's as if you're right there and you're about to graduate, but actually it's written a long time after you've been sent to jail, after things have gone really bad for you and you've been sent to jail. And somebody's writing as if they were giving the commencement and warning you about the things that might happen and that you are ending up in jail, which in fact you have done. And why would that be the case? It's because they're trying to make sense of their circumstances, of this incredible event. It's hugely destructive and fearful event of this invasion by a very powerful Babylon and the loss of everything, the destruction of everything, and then everybody of any importance or power or skill being carried off into exile. So they're writing to try to explain, to try and understand themselves. So how do they do that? Well, go ahead.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes, sure.
This was what I loved about how you taught this, because on page 101 in the workbook, you go and explain, because I never thought about this, that they're trying to make sense of the loss of everything. Mm-hmm. You know? But you say some people responded to them losing everything because they interpret that to mean, I've done something bad, now I'm being punished for it, right?
Absolutely.
And that mentality kind of overshadows the whole Book of Deuteronomy,
it
at least
does.
The way I was taught. You
yeah.
know? But you show here in 101 that there are actually many responses to the loss of the land.
Mm-hmm.
There are different voices that are saying, making meaning of why this happened to them. So you have, for example, Isaiah's language of compassion, nonviolence. Mm. And this nonviolent suffering servant, that's another response. Then you have the wisdom of Genesis and the forgiveness of Joseph, of his brothers. You have Job as an innocent victim, you know, who he's questioning this whole Deuteronomic way of looking at things. He's like, what, you know, I've done everything right. Bad stuff has happened to me. So I found that extremely helpful, extremely helpful. It's just one voice among many.
Right, but the Deuteronomic voice has become the prevailing voice, the one we kind of identify with the Bible. And as you say in your upbringing, your evangelical upbringing, and it's no different in my Catholic upbringing, this is the dominant voice, the one we hear. If you do X, which is bad, God is going to punish you with Y. And in chapter 28 of Deuteronomy, we have this whole list of curses. We have blessings, but it's a much shorter segment. Then we have a much larger segment of all the curses all the bad things that are going to come down on you if you do not obey the law. And so that, because that is almost second nature to human beings, that we have to blame somebody or something for bad things that happen. And in that case, it's blaming of themselves and blaming of that particular generation, but a warning to all the subsequent generations, the ones that come after you've ended up in jail, say, well, you know, this is a teaching for you not to repeat the same thing. So it becomes this kind of dominant voice that's guiding the mind and the kind of hearts of the people. Although there's many, many beautiful things in Deuteronomy, it becomes a very powerful voice that has been inherited by the Christian tradition. So yes, that's that's the Deuteronomic worldview.
Yeah.
So Heather, why is it important to study this Deuteronomic God, but not to follow him?
Yes, I think it's very important not to cross it out, as I was doing previously. You've taught me that, Tony. The reason is that we can see reflected in that voice our own humanity. It's like it's a revelation of how we project our violence onto God. Mm-hmm. And when things go wrong, when there's a crisis, like what these people are experiencing, the loss of everything, they've got to blame someone. So in a sense, I began to see it now that they were actually trying to deal with this by blaming themselves. So it was better than blaming a scapegoat or somebody else. They were trying to take responsibility for why things went wrong. So I can kind of see it as like the first step on a longer journey, you know, of trying to see where God is leading them. And I think it's really, it becomes so rich in that way, rather than just censor it out, to see the whole picture, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also too, because you do mention here in the book about, it's kind of like when someone goes into recovery, you know, and you're, the way that you think 10 years into recovery is very different from when the first day of recovery, you know, and why would I go back to the way I was thinking originally? I mean, it was one step along the way, but why would I make that, okay, you know, have the authority instead of just see, oh, that was really important because I'm a violent person. I'm prone to, you know, turn that violence inward or onto others. So I need to look at that, you mm-hmm. know.
And actually, that's an important point, because this particular story, and also the sixth story about the temple and its deconstruction, we describe those two stories of the seven stories as shell stories. The other stories are very clear. They show how the Bible transforms our understanding of God. But these two shell stories about the land and the temple are a little bit different in that they are seen as necessary steps, important steps for our understanding to change in the future. I was wondering, Tony, if you could tell us a little bit more about what is meant by a shell story.
Well, these are very important concepts, and they're kind of technical in a way, but once we've got them out there, they help us enormously in understanding this material. I mean, you've got this big book that's been composed over 1,000 years, essentially. You kind of need some tools to understand it, you know, just to take it as all the same thing from beginning to end. It's very, very rich. So there are two things that you have to distinguish. One is frame story, and the other is what we are calling shell story. Now, frame story is a conventional term from literary criticism that tells us that a lot of stories begin, a lot of writings and narratives begin with one story and then they lead into another one. And a big example, for example, is the Titanic, the movie Titanic, because that begins with an old lady who's reminiscing about a diamond necklace, or this beautiful diamond that she had, called the Heart of the Sea, and it, then she's talking about that, and that leads you step by step into the actual story of the Titanic with Leonardo DiCaprio and all that, and it becomes very exciting. And then it ends up with the old lady as well. And it kind of tells you where that diamond ends up. And it becomes a way of kind of... So it's a very interesting way of constructing. Now, in the Christian tradition, we have understood the frame story of the Bible to be the book of Genesis and what we call the fall. And that sets the whole thing up, needing to have the crucifixion of Jesus, the cross of Jesus, as a way of making good the sin of our first parents, what I call our first parents. But for the Jewish experience, and this is very important, that is not the frame story of the Bible. That's the way the Christian tradition has interpreted it, but the Jewish experience is the land, is the story of the Exodus, the freedom from oppression in Egypt, and being given the land and being given the law before that. That is the frame in which they understand the Bible, and it makes a huge lot of sense. So, as we have said, that's so important. That story is told twice in the book of Exodus, the book of Deuteronomy. So it's obviously a frame story for their experience of their whole lives, and which is written down in the Bible. Mm-hmm. But when in the seven stories, when we look at the land, because we see that there's a developing narrative all the way through that about the nature of God, and as Heather says, the nature of human. What human beings are, and that they're violent, etc. We see the land also as a shell. It's like an oyster shell. It's like this beautiful thing in which there is something more precious. Mm-hmm. So the Christian narrative that gets you to Jesus is there's this developing story about God and about human beings being told via this story of the land. But the land then drops away in importance. Mm-hmm. And of course it does in the person of Jesus, who really is a landless person. He says, the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And he becomes this element of freedom from that kind of need to hang on to the land and all the associations that unless you are good, God is going to punish you again by the loss of the land, etc. That becomes then this precious element that enabled this land, this shell, that enables us to get to the pearl of something even greater and more freedom and more alive.
Can I ask a question when you say that? So you're talking about when you say the land as shell, that it's the relationship to the land, because, you know, the land was promised to them as part of their freedom when they were slaves. So this is something that they understood as a blessing from God, that they could have land because they were landless people. And then, so now it's this relationship to the land is all mixed in very tight with their relationship to their God. So when they lose the land, that relationship you're saying is kind of like a hard shell that's around a precious pearl. The shell has to be hard in a sense, because what they're discovering is so gentle. You know, when you get to Jesus, he's just so gentle. So is that what you mean by the, you know, you're using this metaphor of shell? I mean, that's really
absolutely
cool.
I mean, that's it there, because
almost like they have to understand, I'm sorry, interrupting you again, but they have to understand God as violent because they are violent.
Right.
But in that understanding, there's this little precious pearl underneath that's kind of carrying it till they get to the point of Jesus, where then you don't need
are the writers of the Bible have a violent mindset, but all human beings are violent. They're no different. And the point is that story and the people in that story are being carried on a journey from something important and powerful, like being oppressed and landless, to being given a land by God and be given a life, but then to be carried further to something even more powerful and deeper, which is the ability to let go of that that material possession that you've been given and that's helped you to grow, and to learn that God is like that, and actually the circumstances of the loss of the land, the invasion of Babylon and the destruction of everything were the first step in them understanding that actually God comes through And is understood, as Heather has mentioned, through the suffering servant, that God is understood much better in terms of this surrender of possession and of power. And of course, then at the same time, you do have the natural Deuteronomic voice that says, no, this is because we've been punished and we have to be good. We have to be much better the second time. So you've got these struggling alternative visions of what it means to be human, what it means to relate to God. But what we're saying is that there's something, this pearl, this freedom, this kind of much more profound freedom is coming through all the time. And of course, is expressed in the person of Jesus who, you know, for example, he chooses people as his disciples who have no land. They're fishermen and they're women, they're powerless women. These people do not have this stake in the land. That's one example of how he's finding this alternative story, which has already begun in the Old Testament, but he's bringing it to full expression.
That's beautiful. And that makes me feel so closer to Jesus, to see that that's what he's responding to. He's kind of responding to that Deuteronomic voice when he's seeking disciples who are like landless people, and he's breaking those codes and those barriers. And so you're saying it's just really hard for us to get and understand this, that God is so powerful and gentle at the same time.
Absolutely. And we need a long training in that. It's hard for us human beings to grasp that.
So, Heather, today's discussion is obviously, it's about the land and its loss. So why do you think the land always seems to provoke violence? Or, I mean, even today in our world, it doesn't take much to see that land boundaries, borders, still evoke the violence in people. Why do you think that is the case?
It is true. Every time you talk about my property and in and out, and this don't go past this line, this is mine, this is yours, you know, it's like we are just so set up as human beings to be in rivalry with one another, to be jealous and wanting what other people have. So it's like these boundaries come into place to kind of keep a little like semi-order, you know, in quotes. It's like, you stay over here, I'll stay here, maybe we won't hurt each other, you know, or if you follow the rules, you know. And it's our like identity. I think about this when you're having that discussion about, you know, kneeling for the flag, and it's kind of like broke my heart, because it's like the flag on the one hand is just a piece of cloth, but what is all the meaning behind this? That some people are, you know, it's really about land. It's about who gets to have claim on that land. You know, the flag. Who's going to say what it means and how they're going to, and they're going to have to kick people out. Some people are going to be not in, you know, and the whole thing with our border, with, you know, refugees coming, you know, children being taken from their parents. Now we're hearing the news. It's like, you know, this is not the way of Jesus. You know, this is not how Jesus did, but this is the way human beings work. This is how we do it. It's like every time there's this discussion about land, it's going to turn violent.
Mm-hmm. And Tony, have you got any comments about this? How people respond to crisis, or, you know, the human being?
Sure. I mean, the whole Seven Stories study is based upon the kind of discoveries, the anthropological discoveries of this great thinker by the name of René Girard, who just died about 3 years ago. Enormously, he took from the Bible a understanding of fundamental anthropology, in other words, the way we're kind of basically structured as human beings. And just as an example, the very first, or the second kind of narrative in the Bible after the Garden of Eden is the story of the murder of Abel by Cain. And that's all set up out of desire and rivalry and then violence. So Girard derived this understanding of human identity and human culture from many examples, many sources, but one of the key sources was the Bible itself, which tells us that human beings are always imitating each other, and part of the imitation very quickly is rivalry. If both of two human beings focus on the same thing because one is focusing on it and the other one imitates the first one who's focused on it, they're going to be in rivalry and conflict over that thing. So they're going to, it's what he calls mimetic rivalry, mimetic conflict. So this is very much part of our understanding of what's going on in the Bible. It's revealing this to us. It's opening up that picture of what humanity is. And so human beings, we understand, are almost kind of their default setting, and it's almost inevitable that they will understand themselves in terms of who is my enemy, who is trying to take stuff away from me, who is to blame for my bad circumstances, who's the one who's responsible for this. And when we can find that person or that individual, then all our anger and our violence is unleashed against that person or set of persons. And so the land is defined by who's inside and who's outside. The outside are the bad people who will want to take this away from us, who want to take away our identity, our importance, whatever it is, and we want to keep them out. Of course, there are economic and real life issues there as well, but they get built up so beyond that in terms of, you know, as Heather has said, in terms of the flag and identity, that kind of thing, then suddenly we're at war. we're killing each other in huge numbers. And that's the enormous risk of our situation today as human beings. So this understanding of the Bible comes at a very crucial moment in human experience. And it tells us that God is always trying to set us free from this, to give us another identity, another way of relating in love and forgiveness and in nonviolence to the other.
Would you say that is our bondage to sin, really?
Really, yes. Or, I mean, we've understood sin morally in terms of, you know, commandments and mores that, you know, once you break that, then you're in sin. But actually, it's a condition of being human in an old way that is sin. That's what it says in the story of Cain. It's the first time sin is mentioned in the Bible. Sin is at your door, and its desire is for you because you actually want to kill your brother. That's the first definition of sin that's given in the Bible, not these individual laws or mores, which, yes, they have their importance because basically they're there in order to protect us from our own violence and the violence of others. But really the basic human condition is what the Bible is trying to revolutionize, to bring about a new sense of what it means to be human.
And I like how you... in the Seven Stories workbook, in the first lesson on that page 101, I'll go back to that again, because those five different voices that you mentioned there, you kind of show how in the third lesson you talk about how Jesus, he synthesized all those different voices into himself, mm-hmm. and then completely rejected the Deuteronomic voice. In everything that he did, he had his own critique and criticism. In fact, you say the Sermon on the Mount is explaining that, you know, you've heard this, you know,
but I tell you should,
you know, I'm telling you, love your enemies. Yeah, you said not, you've heard don't kill, but I'm saying love your enemies.
Do not be angry.
Yeah, don't even be angry with your brother or your sister. So it's like totally transformative in Christ. Mm-hmm. It's like you take, you know, this first prototype of who you think God is, this Deuteronomic type God, and then Jesus, like, it's like, okay, we don't need that one because we've got all these other voices, you know, and what he does with it is so beautiful. And that's what we're supposed to, as Christians, we, you know, have to watch ourselves that we don't get into that in and out group thing.
And actually, in following on from that, the talking about how Jesus took the Deuteronomic voice and reimagined it, but he did keep that relationship, yes. We spoke about earlier, that while he rejects the violence and, as you say, that in and out, you know, the judgment piece of it, he retains what he calls the heart of the law, which is this relationship with the Father.
Yes.
So I was wondering if you wanted to say something a little bit about that, either of you.
Yes, and that was part of why I was so happy, because the chapter 10 of Deuteronomy in verse 12 is the essence of the law. And this is like one of my favorite passages in the whole Bible, but I was having issues because all the other stuff around it I was crossing out. But I would just like to read that now, because
go ahead.
That is such like one of my favorite verses. So chapter 10, verse 12. So now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? Only to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments of the Lord your God, and with his decrees that I am commanding you today for your own well-being. Although heaven and the heaven of heavens belong to the Lord your God, the earth with all that is in it, yet the Lord set his heart in love on your ancestors alone and chose you, their descendants after them, out of all the peoples as it is today. Circumcise then the foreskin of your heart and do not be stubborn any longer, for the Lord your God is the God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who is not partial and takes no bribe, who executes justice for the orphan and the widow, and who loves the strangers, providing them with food and clothing. You shall also love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall fear the Lord your God, him alone you shall worship. To him you shall hold fast, and by his name you shall swear. He is your praise, he is your God, who has done for you these great and awesome things that your own eyes have seen. Your ancestors went down to Egypt 70 persons, and now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars in heaven.
Thank you. Any last thoughts, Tony?
Well, yeah, that's so beautiful. And I'm glad you read us that, Heather, because we're by no means dismissing the voice, the Deuteronomic voice. We're saying there's an element in that, and as in, say, all human beings, I mean, like, just we say, well, you know, there's an element of violence in an individual. You don't reject the individual or that person. But what we're seeing is that the book of Deuteronomy tells us that there's a relationship. It has a relationship, a very powerful relationship. And in fact, that relationship is essential. And Jesus repeats that. He says, what does the law tell you? And when the lawyer asks him what is the greatest commandment, they actually quote from Deuteronomy. He says, you shall love the Lord your God with your whole heart and your whole soul and your whole strength. And Jesus says, you have answered well. So that relationship that the book of Deuteronomy enshrines, and perhaps is the book that most enshrines it, is absolutely essential. And when the people went off into exile in Babylon, that relationship was maintained. The only thing was, what we're saying, is that because the structure of their mind and thinking, which is the same for all, was still generative violence, they make sense out of violence, they, at the same time as retaining the relationship, they said, well, there was punishment as part of this relationship, that God punished us. He still loves us. He still has a relationship with us. He still has chosen us, but he's punishing us because of the bad things we did. So those two things were put together. So what we're saying is that the relationship is essential. The thought of punishment is actually contingent. It's secondary. It belongs to the slow evolution of human beings. Now, I'm not saying that, this is something that Paul had to deal with. We're not saying, oh, it's okay to sin, to do bad things. No, because the consequences of sin is violence. The consequences of that are death. So, you know, it's still the same conditions belong to human experience, that this will lead us to die. But what we're saying is the character of God And the essence of this relationship is all love. And it takes time to get to that. And so the Deuteronomic voice is kind of the kind of superstructure. It's the overlay on the basis of that relationship. And you have to say that in many ways it helped preserve the people when, you know, if they say, well, God punished us. Well, we have to be better this time. And when we go back and, you know, we're in the land and this is what happened. We have to be stricter as a people about ourselves. Yes, it did help preserve that identity. And it was a necessary part of the history. And it's in a way a wonderful part of history because it was obedient or tried to be obedient, and it was devoted to this God. But there was something trying to break through it, something yeah. much more wonderful and liberating trying to break. And that's the huge kind of drama and risk of being a Christian is that there is no law. It's gone. And the threats of the law are gone. The sanctions of punishment are gone. So what are you left with? You know, you say, well, I got this enormous freedom. You know, what do I do with it? Well, you are free. And it's part of the kind of the ethic of the West, the freedom, should we say. But freedom really essentially is love. Yes. And when you understand that, then you are then at the service of all. So it's really, it's a matter of continuing that path all the way through to its final meaning and conclusion. So the Deuteronomic voice is essential.
Yes.
It's absolutely essential. You have to hear it, you have to read it, you have to understand it, you have to follow it through. But, you know, don't do what it does in right. some respect.
Okay, thank you. And thank you so much, Heather, for being our guest today.
You're so welcome.
And for being such an important part of our community. We value you so much. So as we conclude, we invite our listeners to check out our website, www.woodhathhope.org, and Tony and I hope that you will tune in next time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.